Molten lava erupting into darkness and elephants crossing a dusky plain as birds fly overhead. BBC Natural World. In slow motion, pristine blue waters curl into a rolling wave. A man cruises across the water on a canoe. Waves crash, spraying white water into the air. A turtle floats beneath the waves. Viewed from beneath the ocean, the canoe's paddle dips into the water. Another wave crashes onto a sandy beach.
My ancestors, the first Hawaiians, came to these islands many centuries ago. Their voyage across 2,500 miles of open ocean was an incredible feat of navigation and survival.
They've got so much water, they've got so much food with them, they know that's all they have. Hopefully they can catch fish along the way, they can catch rainwater along the way, but other than that, they're dependent on what they have on that canoe and they need to manage it well.
Eventually, they found land, an island paradise, teeming with life. But they soon found out this newfound wealth was exhaustible. To survive on an island, you have to learn to live within your means, just like in a canoe.
A lot of us today, we still look at the island as a canoe. That what we've got is what we've got, and if we waste it, we're done.
He paddles across the water.
Live like you're on a canoe.
Hawaii. Message in the waves. Narrated by Yokapa Naole. He gets out of the canoe and lifts it onto his shoulder.
My name is Yokapa Naole, and I'm a kumuao, a teacher. This is my school on the edge of the ocean.
Pupils are wearing face masks.
Here, I play my small part in shaping the Hawaiians of the future. I teach the kids all the usual things, but as much as possible, I like to get them outside.
After we got it all mapped out.
It's called the Hawaii Outdoor Education Program, and it's our aim to help kids learn by connecting with the world around them. Observing what's out there and learning from it, it's nothing new. This is the way my ancestors worked out how to survive on these islands. For me, that's the foundation of being Hawaiian.
As a Hawaiian living in a place like this, I wake up in the morning, first thing I'm looking at is I'm looking for the sun, I'm looking for the wind direction, I'm looking for the swells, the waves. Everything I see is part of my environment, it's part of me.
Waves lap against a sandy beach.
But for most Hawaiians, that changed with the arrival of the Western world. We were encouraged to look at our surroundings in a very different way. Our culture, rooted in nature, was dismissed as primitive.
They were taught that being Hawaiian wasn't necessarily something to be proud of. My grandfather was actually physically punished for speaking Hawaiian in school. Being Hawaiian was something that you should put on the side because we're living in the Western society now. We're in a society where you need to learn how to speak proper English. You need to be able to go out and make money, buy a home, 2-car garage, 2 cars. Those are the important things. So all of the things Hawaiian, even speaking our own language, that was all just cast aside.
The setting sun bathes the sky in shades of amber.
Today, our culture is in a renaissance, and we have a growing sense of pride in our heritage. We have been rediscovering many aspects of what it is to be Hawaiian. But there was something at the core of the old culture that has been slower to return.
It was because of the culture being suppressed and kind of belittled, that the values disappeared. Simple values like conservation and sharing.
Waves crash onto rocks.
We've always been a progressive culture, not afraid of change. But the welfare of the natural world is no longer the core of how we live. As a result, I believe we are in danger of destroying paradise. Now, more than ever, we need to rethink our relationship with nature.
Cars driving along a road by the coast.
Being Hawaiian today is much more than being able to connect yourself in your genealogy to the ancients, the ones that settled here. It's much more than that. Being Hawaiian is all about connecting yourself to this place.
A pristine beach with mountains in the distance.
In many ways, this place is still the paradise my ancestors discovered. A long chain of volcanic islands, each one unique, but all of them isolated by the vastness of the Pacific Ocean. Here on the most remote islands on the planet, the ocean is our lifeblood. If we're to get reconnected to nature, this is where we need to start.
The ocean is dotted with surfers.
He'e Nalu, or wave sliding, was perfected here on these same waves over 800 years ago. Like many aspects of our culture, it was once banned by the missionaries from the West, but now has become so popular, it is one of the fastest growing sports, not only in Hawaii, but in the whole world. Through the rebirth of surfing, a new generation of Hawaiians are beginning to reconnect with what makes Hawaii so special.
My name is Jack Johnson, and I grew up here in Hawaii on the north side of the island. It's called the North Shore, and pretty much surfed any second I had a chance to, and just grew up surfing all the time. I like spending time in the water, whether it's sailing or snorkeling or it could be anything, just taking a swim. And it's nice to have fish around and the ecosystems that are created around a coral reef. You know, it's you take away the reef, you take away the whole system.
A school of yellow fish with black stripes.
The coral reefs that fringe much of the Hawaiian coastline are the basis for most of the life found in our ocean here. They are also a natural defense against Pacific swells, and they create the waves that made Hawaii famous.
A surging wave.
Hawaii comes straight up out of its volcanoes from the ocean floor, and so the waves in these open ocean swells are very deep and they're traveling very fast. And when they hit the coral reefs, which just jut up, going so fast, by the time it slows down, it's really dramatic and it pitches out and it gets these really hollow waves and they're really beautiful to look into from the side.
A wall of water arches over itself, curling into a cascading wave. A surfer rides a towering wave. An underwater view reveals a rolling barrel of water, the surfer's hands skimming the surface. A wave crashes into some rocks, sending a turtle flying backwards through the water. A surfer rides the crest of a wave, then flips into the air, parting company with his board. In slow motion, he sails high above the water, then plunges down into the ocean.
Surfing is totally dependent on the forces of nature. To surf well, you spend so much time immersed in the natural environment that it starts to change the way you think.
Just sitting out there floating at sea, looking back at the land, it almost feels like those pictures from space looking back at Earth. You feel pretty small in nature, and I think it's like, have a lot of time to ponder and think about things and what's been going on in your life. If everything's been fast-paced, it's this hour or two you have to really concentrate on what's important. And you're thinking about nature a lot. Hopefully you start thinking about what you can do to help.
A lone swimmer.
My ancestors found out the hard way that nature needed help.
When they first settled islands, they didn't do things perfectly. There was a lot to learn for them.
Of all the ecosystems they depended on, the reef was the most important and the most fragile. If the reef suffered, they suffered. Over many generations, through trial and error, they came up with a system that allowed them to harvest the island's natural resources, but at the same time, protecting them.
Back then, in order for the culture and the society to survive, you had to make sure that everything was in lokahi, everything was in harmony. So drastic measures were taken to ensure that through kapu.
Kapu, in the Hawaiian language, means forbidden. If an animal or plant or even a whole reef was suffering from human impact, it was declared kapu. It meant you couldn't touch it, you couldn't pick it, you couldn't kill it, and you certainly couldn't eat it.
The penalties were so severe that it would be a very uncommon thing for someone to go out and do something against the law. If you took the wrong fish, you could pay for it, you know, with your life. That's how seriously they took it back then.
Obviously, in today's world, that would be a punishment too severe. But I believe that the ideas and principles our ancestors lived by should be taken seriously again. The story of the green sea turtle shows us that those old ideas are still relevant today. The green sea turtle was once reserved for only the royal table, but with the end of the kapu system, it became food for anyone's table. Just in time, someone saw what was going on.
It really wasn't until about 1969 that I became aware and concerned about sea turtles in Hawaii. When we were sitting down on the dock, a boat came in, and there were local fishermen on it, and they had, lo and behold, they had turtles stacked up left and right in this boat. And I asked the fellow, where are these turtles going? My goodness, where did you get so many turtles? And they said, oh, they were going to some of the tourist restaurants. They paid them $1 a pound. Whoa, 100-pound turtle, $100 bill. This is pretty good. For the fishermen anyway, but then I started thinking how many turtles could be taken and the population sustain. The French frigate Shoals up past the island of Kauai, 400 miles past Kauai, accounts for about 90% of the nesting throughout the entire Hawaiian chain. In the summer of 1973, on the single most important islet at French frigate Shoals, we counted 67 turtles. And that didn't seem like very many turtles to me, to be a major part of the breeding herd. If some reasonable steps weren't taken to put the brakes on this hunting, this was going to destroy a wonderful part of the Hawaiian ecosystem.
By the mid-1970s, there was a reprieve for the turtle. They were declared an endangered species and protected by law. For the first time in nearly 200 years, turtles were effectively kapu. This modern form of protection was doing what the old Hawaiians had known centuries ago. Give nature a chance, and it will recover.
A turtle swimming through the water.
You can now see turtles here, there, and nearly everywhere. The key factors that have led to this road to recovery that we're seeing with the Hawaiian turtle clearly relate to the single act of stopping the harvesting. Stopping the hunting, stop killing them, let them reproduce, and they will replenish themselves if a sufficient time has gone by.
Two turtles floating in the water.
I see turtles all over the place. Every time I get out of my canoe, I'm weaving in between turtles. I don't look at them as food. I'm sorry, it's just not the same anymore. Realizing how close they were to going extinct, for me, it's a species that is hands off now.
Under protection, the green turtle's recovery has been incredible. Sadly, though, other native animals with the same level of protection continue to decline. Scientists believe the Hawaiian monk seal may not survive. The threat to the monk seal is not hunting, but loss of habitat. In old Hawaii, declaring an animal kapu was only part of the story. Back then, they understood that you cannot protect a species without protecting the ecosystem that supports it. But to protect an ecosystem, you need a detailed understanding of how it works. There were individuals in old Hawaii who had just that. They were called the Konohiki.
The Konohiki was the one appointed by the chiefs to make sure that from the top of the mountain all the way out to the ocean, that it was run efficiently and with conservation in mind.
The Konohiki were all scientists. They looked at every detail in the world around them. They counted the birds, monitored the fish, and decided whether the island ecology was in balance.
You could call them the game warden. You could call them the natural resource manager. You could call them the judge as well when it came to enforcing the kapu.
Today, the Konohiki are all gone, but the need for them is just as great. Now it's up to anyone who spends time in the wild to watch out for the environment. At any hint of a problem, it's up to us to raise the alarm.
We've got to be the Konohiki now.
A woman wearing a bathing suit stares out at the ocean. She's perched on the edge of a rock jutting out over the water. In slow motion, she throws a snorkel into the water, then dives over the edge in a graceful arc. She slices into the water, wearing flippers on her feet, a cloud of bubbles churning around her body.
A lot of people my age, they go to bars and they go to clubs, and that's how they have a good time. For me, I'm never more content than when it's me and a turtle or a fish or a pod of dolphins or a shark. It's just, it's all in your preference. And for me, being in that environment with those animals is where I belong. I think that there's not even a comparison for freediving and scuba diving for me. You can't swim very fast and it restricts you with the animals. Freediving, it's just you, your fins, your mask and snorkel in the ocean.
She kicks off from the ocean floor and floats towards the surface. Morgan Hostery, free diver and surfer.
Water people in general are the best friend that the ocean has because we respect it and we love it so much that we want to preserve and protect it. Just from the sheer amount of man hours that we spend in the ocean, we've seen things that maybe a lot of people don't know are there.
A red leaf floating in the water.
One of the saddest signs of the times for me is seeing what the dolphins are playing with. The best kind of toys that you see them with are obviously leaves. Leaves that have drifted offshore, they'll take them and they'll pick them up either with their rostrum or they'll pick them up on their pectoral fins. They'll come and they'll pick it up and they'll swim with it and they'll swim fast enough so the leaf will stay there.
A pod of dolphins cruising gently through the pale blue water.
But also, when they're not playing with leaves, since there's a lot of plastic in the water, you see them a lot with the plastic grocery bags.
A dolphin with a plastic bag caught on its fin.
There's a lot of instances where it could get stuck on their blowhole or it will get stuck around their rostrum so they can't open their mouth or they'll swallow it and it'll clog their throat.
Dolphins arc through the water.
I think that plastic has become an alternative, if not the main thing that they have to play with out there.
A dolphin swims to the water's surface and hooks a plastic bag on its fin.
Dolphins playing with plastic bags may appear to many people as unfortunate or even unpleasant. But to a Konohiki, it would be seen as a sign. A warning sign that we are placing our environment under unnatural and mounting pressure.
A plane soars over the mountains, then a bustling beach.
To the rest of the world, Hawaii is seen as the typical island paradise. That obviously attracts visitors. And in the age of cheap air travel, lots of visitors. Today, we have about 1 million residents, but a further 7 million people arrive each year for a few weeks in paradise.
It's the main source of income in the islands, towards the tourist industry. And it's, if not looked after, it's gonna slowly eat everything up and just take away everything that people come here for.
You've got a visitor industry that is designed to please the visitor, take their money. Before, the ocean was our refrigerator. Now it's like a cash cow for many people.
In fast motion, two cruise boats come to a stop in the middle of the ocean. Then the passengers disembark for a swim. Gonna wash these blues away, man, this city. An underwater view of the swimming tourists. I'ma head out to the country, find a place where a turtle swims at the water's surface, attracting the attention of the tourists, then dives down beneath the sea. You can buy me true love. Tourists explore the coral, wearing flippers on their feet. That the only true fortune you can save. In fast motion, the pleasure seekers pile back onto the boats and sail away.
We want visitors to enjoy our ocean and wildlife. But now the tourist industry is encouraging too many people into the water without any real thought for the damage they can cause.
Morgan finds a chain tied to a rock at the bottom of the ocean.
In a normal freediving session for me, I may see boat anchors that have torn off coral heads, so you see a broken coral head lying there on the floor, or depending on where you go, you see people that just don't know any better that are standing on the coral heads, not knowing what they're doing.
Coral reefs are very fragile. Just one touch from a finger can kill a coral polyp. In some of the bays most heavily publicized by the visitor industry, up to 90% of the coral is now make, dead.
A tourist wearing flippers clambers over the dead brown coral.
The irony is that as the industry strives for ever greater profits, it's transforming the landscape that attracted the visitors in the first place.
A cluster of high-rise hotels.
What are people coming to Hawaii for? They're not coming here just to see hotel buildings. They're coming here to experience, you know, things out of nature, to see beautiful coral reefs, to see beautiful mountains. Let's not throw away the reason that people are coming. I mean, you could really shoot yourself in the foot by taking away all the reasons.
The islands have become a playground for visitors, but it's all of us who are paying the price.
A golf course.
One of my best places, my favorite places when I was growing up to go camping is now a huge hotel right on the property. We've developed our coastline so much that we no longer have access to the simple things in life that kept us, you know, happy.
Diggers move around a building site.
Call someplace paradise and kiss it goodbye, yeah? It's the same all over the world.
The shadows of clouds glide across the landscape.
It's easy to think that all these problems are someone else's fault. But I think, whether you were born here or whether you're here for just 2 weeks, everyone has a role to play in making things right. The ancestors had a principle which I think could help steer us back on course.
The word kuleana means privilege and responsibility. It's that double-edged sword. If you have the privilege of enjoying something, you also have the responsibility to protect it.
As a teacher, I believe it's my kuleana, my responsibility, to encourage people to act more like the Hawaiians of old and take better care of these islands.
The key is to work on this next generation right here and create a whole new army of environmental thinkers.
Well, the first step is to get them off the couch. My school is part of Hawaiian Canoe Club. outrigger paddling is not only culturally significant, but also a lot of fun and a great way to get kids to start seeing the world as the ancients did.
It's your refrigerator, it's your playground, it's your gym, it's your church, it's everything to you. The ocean is our life as Hawaiians.
Everybody ready to race? Okay, let me hear it. Otter Pop. Koi
Hapai!
Koi Hapai!
Koi
Hapai! Have fun!
Teams of kids race across the water on long canoes.
When you get kids out onto the open ocean, they have to work together, and they have to understand better the rhythms of the ocean, how small they are, and how precarious our existence is. It makes them realize that there's more to life than TVs and MP3 players. The more you get kids out there, the more they ask questions. They see stuff that doesn't belong, and they want to know, who put this plastic bag in the water? How come it's brown today and not so blue? They want to know who's polluting their environment.
You could sit in a classroom all day and try to teach kids about preserving the ecology and the environment, but it takes a few hours to get them out there and have them witness something that'll change their life forever.
A pod of dolphins swim through the water, then a shark emerging from the darkness. A school of blackfish, then a turtle swimming gracefully through the water. Morgan paddles out in the ocean on her surfboard. The turtle explores a rock. Lying on her surfboard, Morgan paddles towards a rising wave. She turns on her back, submerging herself under the water whilst clinging onto the surfboard above as the wave washes over her. She rises up out of the water, riding her surfboard as it slides over some incoming waves.
Other sides and the show disappears with a note. Until next time. Long live living, if living can be this.
Morgan carefully stands up on her board and rides the surf.
Long live living, if living can be this.
She stretches out her arms for balance as she glides over the waves. A plastic bag floats in the water.
To be able to go surf someplace, you know, that's such a privilege. There's something that you have to do to earn that privilege. And if it's cleaning up the beach, that's one thing. If it's going out there diving and picking up debris from the reef, going out there and cleaning something up like that, that gives you privilege, but you gotta earn them.
Do you ever look around and find what is yet to be found?
It's never too big a task when you're out in the water to try to clean up everything that you see. I'll pick up the plastic and I'll stuff it in my leash, or I'll, you know, tie it to the leash cord in the back, or any way that I can kind of secure it down. If I see it, I'm gonna pick it up. I never just leave it there. Just leaving it there is just as bad as you just going and throwing it there in the first place. It's the same thing.
Plastic clinging to a turtle's face.
Everyone here has a responsibility to help. It's up to each Hawaiian to work out how they can be most effective. If you can inspire thousands of people as you do it, so much the better.
Well, right now, we'd like to bring all around here, guys, for the kids. We got a song. We play in the school sometimes. I want to hear it loud, just like the kids.
Music's always just been a little hobby. The last few years, it's become definitely more of something I do. And it's brought a lot of attention to myself. And so I've decided to kind of take some of that attention and focus it on some issues back here in Hawaii. And so we started this foundation. It's called the Kukua Hawaii Foundation. And Kukua in the Hawaiian language means to help.
It's a magic number. Woo!
We saw there was a little bit of a hole as far as working with kids and getting them ready for the future. And we do things like startup recycling programs, and we fund field trips that send kids out into nature where they go and learn about native plants and animals.
Okay, ready?
One, two.
I was in the studio recording a record, and I had the idea of reduce, reuse, recycle, but I kind of just made the song up in about an hour there. Kids' songs, it's always fun. You don't have to like overanalyze it. You know, you just try to make it funky and fun.
Because 2 times 3 is 6. And 3 times 6 is 18. And the 18th letter in the alphabet is R.
As a kid, I grew up dreaming about being on a deserted island and having to figure out how would you survive.
We gotta learn to reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle.
I think that's kind of like what life's about, is trying to be sustainable.
Reuse, recycle. Now if you're going to the market to buy some juice, bring your own bags and you learn to reduce your waste. You gotta reduce
your waste. It's funny because kids just start singing it and some of them probably think, you know, this is important stuff. Other ones just think it's fun. They get to dance and yell out and the words kind of sink in. Then I'll meet kids around and they'll start singing the song to me.
All right, everybody sing. Reduce, reuse, recycle. That's good. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle.
Reduce, reuse, recycle. A simple message of how to live within your means.
It's a magic.
It's basically what we learned in that canoe all those centuries ago. That message is now spreading beyond the schoolroom and into our communities.
It's a magic.
But just as we're learning to think Hawaiian again, it's no longer enough. Our islands are now facing a problem so large that we Hawaiians cannot solve it alone.
A plastic bottle rolls across the beach, blown by the wind. A shoreline littered with rubbish. A man wearing a shirt with insignia on the shoulder epaulettes is sorting through the detritus.
On the bottom of the sea. What did the deep sea say?
Waves lap against an empty beer crate left on the rocks.
It moaned and groaned.
The man trudges through the multitude of litter. Captain Charles Moore.
We're currently on Camillo Beach on the Big Island of Hawaii. This area is an accumulation point for marine debris. It's currently in the running for the title of dirtiest beach in the world. Most of this debris is not from Hawaiians themselves, not from products that are consumed here, not from tourists that use the beaches. Most of it comes from what we call the Pacific Rim, the area on the continents surrounding Hawaii. The shores of Hawaii are littered with the debris of civilization.
Every year, the world produces nearly 150 billion kilograms of plastic. It is thought that as much as half ends up in the environment. Once there, it doesn't break down. It just accumulates.
The idea that plastics are throwaway materials, to use once and toss, that was a concept developed to use the vast productivity generated by our economic system in World War II to keep it moving, keep it going after the war came to a close. It was decided, well, we'll generate a throwaway society. This is in part responsible for what you're seeing here, and I think if we had the tools to be archaeologists of plastic and to date it, we would find that some of the particles here date from the dawn of the plastic era in the 1950s.
He walks on.
Hawaii is the most remote island chain in the world. And yet, global garbage is found from the shores of Camillo Beach right up to the northwestern limits of the archipelago, 1,500 miles away. The islands to the northwest are the oldest in the chain. There were once great volcanoes, like the main islands, but have slowly sunk back down into the ocean.
So we call the Northwest Hawaiian Islands the Kupuna Islands because that's exactly what they are. Kupuna are our elders.
A view through the window of a plane flying high over the islands. Morgan's looking out of the window.
By us going up there and looking what is happening to the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, we're learning from that. And that's what kupuna do. They teach the younger generation. And sometimes they have very harsh lessons to teach.
We hear mixed reports about the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. On one hand, what I've seen of them on TV is just, you know, there's seabirds everywhere and there's monk seals and there's spinner dolphins, and it seems like such a cool place. But I've also read reports on the other hand that, you know, there's beaches there that are covered in trash.
The plane descends towards the runway. It comes into land. Dolphins dart through the water.
These small and isolated islands have never been permanently settled by people, and so have remained a sanctuary for Hawaiian wildlife. In June 2006, the Northwest Hawaiian Islands were made a U.S. National Monument, the largest fully protected marine conservation area on the planet. The continuing health of these islands is critical to the survival of some of Hawaii's most vulnerable species.
The Northwest Hawaiian Islands Marine Ecological Reserve is a national treasure. It's protected by law.
A seal lounging on the beach.
There is no law that can stop the drift of oceanic currents. And there is no law that can stop the oceanic currents from bringing plastic debris to those islands.
Debris is scattered around the beach where the seal is lying.
But as it exists now, the Hawaiian chain is in dire threat daily from tons and tons of marine debris of every description, causing every type of ecological harm that you can imagine.
A seal with its neck caught in a length of rope. Another seal on the beach, its snout trapped in a piece of rubber tubing. A bird struggling to free itself from a plastic coat hanger hooked around its neck.
Midway, the most famous of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, has the harshest lesson of all.
A slab of concrete on the beach.
Midway played a pivotal role in the Second World War, but now it's part of the National Monument. For the last 50 years, animals have been recolonizing the island and living quite comfortably among the remnants of war.
A seal lying amongst heaps of rusted metal, then a seabird hovering in midair, flapping its wings energetically.
Midway is the breeding ground of millions of seabirds, including 90% of the world's Lizan albatross.
A cluster of albatross standing about in a grassy area. Morgan cycles past on a bike.
It's hard for me to imagine that at one point there were planes taking off and landing all the time on Midway, being such a central part in the war, because now it seems like the albatrosses have just kind of taken over the island. They're everywhere. At the height of the season, there's about 1.4 million albatross on the island. If you think about it, that's a lot of birds.
Morgan's lying on the ground, taking a close-up picture of the birds. One nibbles at the camera, curiously.
During the nesting season, the Lizan albatross chicks are confined to this small piece of land in the middle of the Pacific. They are completely dependent on what their parents bring them to eat from the open ocean. They fatten up for 7 months, then the young albatrosses should be fit, ready to fledge, and able to begin fending for themselves. But these days, many of them are barely getting off the ground.
A scrawny-looking albatross stands on the grass. Morgan parks her bike and puts down her bag.
When I first pulled up to this little corner, it was horrifying. I didn't know it was here, and I kind of looked at it, and it's horrible. There's trash, there's plastic, there's dead albatrosses. It's just awful. A lot of them, that they try to fly, and you know that once those wings go in the water, it's trouble because they get all waterlogged. I feel so badly for these guys who are sitting here, but some of them, the ones who look fairly healthy, I don't want to move them. I don't want to bug them. I don't want to tire them out any more than they are. But the ones that do come down and get stuck up on the rocks, I want to pull those guys out.
She closes one hand around the beak of an albatross and uses the other to lift it out of the water.
Many albatross chicks are just too weak to make it to adulthood. To find out why, you need to look at what the parents are unwittingly feeding them.
My science class was given these boluses of these liaison albatrosses to dissect. And the bolus is basically what the albatross regurgitates. What we found was very little of the stomach contents was actually what they normally eat, their regular diet. Most of what we found in each albatross bolus was marine debris, plastic lighters, floaters, fishing lures, even little plastic toys. What my kids began to express to me was basically, how the heck? How did these foreign objects get into the stomach of this albatross?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Liaison albatross assume that anything floating on the ocean surface is edible. For millions of years, this has been a fair assumption. But today, in some parts of the Pacific, there is more plastic than food.
The entire Pacific Ocean is circulating this debris. So there are many billions of particles circulating in this never-ending spiral that may never touch land and will just constantly be in the ocean until they're degraded to the point where they either sink to the bottom or they become ingested by some creature.
Morgan lifts another albatross out of the polluted water.
In nature, albatross chicks typically die from either starvation or dehydration, and that's kind of the way it's always been. Plastics help this process along by taking up room in their stomachs that would normally be reserved for food and water. So when you have an albatross chick that's got half a stomach full of plastic, that's half a stomach that can't be used.
Morgan walks amongst dead albatrosses littered on the ground.
So as you kind of walk around this nesting colony, all that you really see left are just the dead ones. And you can see in the dead ones that have been left here for a while, they've started to decay. And inside those, you can see a lot of the plastics that have been left behind.
A golf ball and assorted plastic items.
What I think that I might do is wander around for about an hour and just pick up the noticeable, recognizable bits, and then hopefully I can take them down to the beach and lay them out so we can get a better idea of what's out there.
Morgan puts items into a brown paper bag.
At first glance, it doesn't really seem like there's too many plastics on the ground, but once you start looking around and taking a closer look, you just see that it's everywhere.
Morgan walks past a decomposed albatross.
Even in the old days, the Hawaiians used to look at certain species to get an idea of what's going on out there and where they should start to apply different kapu and restrictions. Sadly, these birds are giving their lives to show us what we're doing to the oceans.
Morgan's laying dozens of pieces of plastic on the beach.
So I spent about an hour this afternoon walking around, picking up all the plastic that I could find out of the dead albatross chicks and the boluses if they pop up. I've kind of laid it out here based on just kind of different categories of the stuff that I found. The fishing gear is what you would expect to find. Lines get broken and floats get lost and stuff like this. So this type of stuff isn't quite so surprising. If you aren't a fisherman, you're probably feeling pretty good about yourself right now. You're thinking, okay, this isn't my fault, so now I'm gonna pick on the smokers. These are all lighters. And if you're a golfer, here's some golf balls, roller balls that come in your deodorant. We have all these kids' toys, a bunch of combs and brushes. So if you guys drink juice in the morning, here's a glue stick, a few glue sticks actually. Here's a little gun, which is kind of fitting for Midway, I guess. Everyone knows Santa Claus. Some print cartridges. If you think about how big the albatrosses are and how big their necks are, this is about the same size. It's amazing that they can even get these things down. It can't be very comfortable for them. next one. We have a bunch of pens that have made it over here. There's a bunch of toothpicks. This is somewhat of a monstrosity. Door handles, clothespins. It's a baby rattle. There's still actually lip balm in it. I wouldn't want to use it. If I was an albatross, I don't think that I would like to swallow this. Still, if you've made it this far without thinking that something that you use has become a problem, the toothbrushes should get you, because I know that everybody uses toothbrushes. Every single piece of this plastic that we've pulled out of the albatross colonies has come here in an albatross. It hasn't washed up on the beach. It hasn't been dumped here by humans. It came here inside a bird.
The stomach of an albatross containing a myriad of plastic.
I don't think that people actually realize on a day-to-day basis what the impact actually is. We did this. We all did this to them, and it's just horrid. It's horrifying.
Captain Charles Moore is walking through the debris.
Throw away living may be profitable, but the consequences are intolerable. It's certainly a problem for everyone, and it will require all facets of society to solve it. The ocean itself eventually will spit this stuff out, but we have to stop putting it in. If we don't stop putting it in, it will never be able to spit it all out. And that's the situation we're in right now.
Waves lap over a doll's head lying on the sand.
When Hawaii, one of the most isolated places on the planet, is damaged by the world's wasteful and unsustainable living, we should all sit up and pay attention. Our tiny islands are offering up a warning, but also can provide some hope. Hawaiian history has shown us that sustainable living is not impossible. If it's been done before, it can be done again. We just need to work out what's important to us.
If you have an environment like this to live in, you can have any mansion, any jet plane, you can keep it, okay? I'm rich, I've got everything I need. As a society, we have to realize that this wealth is exhaustible. If we don't use it wisely, that wealth will turn into poverty for us, and this poverty means not being able to survive. When this is gone, it's already gone. We can't mail order anything else.
It's no longer enough for just us on our islands to rediscover how to live within our means. We all have to think Hawaiian now. Live like you're in a canoe.
A fluffy white chick standing next to a discarded hard hat.
There's three R's we're gonna talk about today. You gotta learn to reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle. 'Cause three, that's the magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number.
In loving memory of Tim Green, 1974 to 2017.